This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now is New York Times bestselling author, novelist and screenwriter, including non-fiction works, Blitz to Drugs in Nazi Germany, and his latest release, Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. Norman Ohler, good morning and welcome to Counterculture. How are you?
Good morning. Quite good. I just woke up, so this is my first contact with reality on this day, and I'm quite happy it's with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Now, I have to ask, I had a look at your website. Your website says, I write books, some fiction, some are not. How does a German fiction writer end up writing a book about drugs in Nazi Germany? That's a bit of a leap, my friend.
It is actually. It was a very lucky and unusual leap, and it happened in 2010, so a long time ago, I guess. At the time, I was still only a novelist, and I still consider actually the novel to be the king form or queen form of writing, Königsform, we say in German. I don't know if that translates into English. I still consider the writing a novel the best way to express yourself in writing. Something happened in 2010 because I was told by a friend of mine, a DJ from Berlin, the resident DJ of the Club of Visionaries, that the Nazis took all these drugs and that I should write about this. And I thought, yeah, that sounds like a great topic for the next novel, because I was sure it's just I was sure he was on drugs, just kind of making this up, because I had not heard before ever that the Nazis would take drugs. I knew quite a lot about National Socialism, because we do get educated, at least we did get educated in Germany in the 80s when I went to school. So I was pretty sure I knew most, I was, pretty knowledgeable about that era, and no one had ever mentioned drugs. The opposite actually was mentioned, that the Nazis were, horrible and murderers and criminals and racists and whatever, but there was always this kind of notion that they were disciplined and that there was some kind of law and order in Germany. I was a bit skeptical about that, but it really doesn't point in the direction of drugs. I mean, it points into another direction. So when my DJ friends told me this, that the Nazis took all these drugs, I thought it's just, just a crazy idea that he has for a novel of mine. So I thought, yeah, maybe that's good for a novel. But then I started researching just a little bit online, and there was not much to be found, but there was one scientific article that a German scholar for medicine history had written, and this was Dr. Peter Steinkamp, a scholar that was researching all kinds of things, medicine and history, and he published this one paper in a scientific journal claiming... It was like only two or three pages claiming that the German army had used methamphetamine and that the victories of the German army were only due to this methamphetamine. And this was actually quite interesting to me. So I emailed this guy and he said, yeah, this is a big topic, but no one's ever written about it. But I basically don't have time to really explore it, because his research area was not really that field. So we met and he told me where I could go into the archives and look at actual documents proving that the German army was basically on drugs the whole time, which is a great topic, So I did go to the archives for the first time in my life. I went to an archive and I loved it there with the help of the archivists, who were quite friendly in that archive. I could retrieve a lot of stuff, and then I decided to actually, yes, write a book about Nazis and drugs, write a novel about Nazis and drugs. Then I discussed this with my publisher, and he also had never heard of it. And he said, actually, this is too sensitive, or too important, maybe you could call it, to be put in a novel, because in a novel, people might enjoy, a novel is about literary style, it's about characters, it's about drama, it's not about reality. And he said, this is about reality. This is, we want to know what really happened. So you have to write a nonfiction book. I'm not going to publish your novel on Nazis and drugs, but I would love to publish your nonfiction book on Nazis and drugs. And I said, I'm not going to do that, really. I think nonfiction books are boring. I'd never actually read a nonfiction book. I mean, I'm really into novels. So I thought nonfiction books are, especially German historical nonfiction books, I thought they're dry and unreadable. And most of them actually are. So he said, why don't you write a great nonfiction book? One that, you know, is written in with the language that you use when you write a novel, but, you know, everything in it shall be true and shall be, you know, shall have a source, you know, so people can actually look it up. People that can actually go to the archive and look at the same documents than you. So you need, you know, you need like an apparatus. So I thought it's kind of an interesting, it would be an interesting experience. And I did it. And that's the book Blitzed.
And I mean, writing it in an approachable style for people, I think, is part of the success of the book. I mean, how many copies have you sold since it was released?
I actually don't know. I think between 500,000 and 1,000,000. So it's quite a big success, because my novels before sold in the thousands, which is normal for a novel in Germany. So it was really a great idea of my publisher, actually. But he also made a mistake. We'll come to the mistake a bit later on when we talk about Tripped. Mm. Let's keep in mind that that publisher really shaped my publishing agenda. No, it was great. It was it's translated into over 30 languages, and I heard that also in New Zealand it's a popular book. So it's quite surprising. It's actually not surprising to me, because while I researched, I thought this story is so crazy that it will interest everyone. But it has been a fun ride.
Well, it also to explain so many things, like when you look at the Blitzkrieg. Day and night and day and night and day and night, you have this caravan that move across Central Europe and they never seem to take a break. And you think to yourself, how on earth do they do that in human endurance? Well, it's quite easy if you're hopped up on meth, isn't it, to sort of get from point A to point B.
I mean, this attack of Germany against the West, France and Great Britain, is something that we all kind of know about, that it happened and that Germany was first, you know, having great successes. And I mean, no one really knows what actually did happen and how this was possible. And also, if you read like military history books, they kind of explain like the movement of the troops, but there's no real life to these explanations. Like you're not there. You don't understand actually what happened, especially in combination with methamphetamine, why methamphetamine was so crucial, like what the strategy really was. So I really looked at what happened. And so this Western campaign in the book is like, I don't know, 40 or 50 pages, and you're really there. And for me, that was a first time experience, and it's quite interesting. I mean, it's kind of nerdy to really understand how a military campaign works, especially when drugs are involved, but it was fun to tell this tale, actually.
Also, too, part of the German campaign was heavily based around science and experimentation at the time. So I guess when you look at it from that perspective, it's hardly surprising that they used drugs in terms of a form of warfare, you know, to actually aid their cause, which then sort of leads into when you head to Tripped, which then talks more about the development of LSD. Now, one of the things I found really fascinating with that is, of course, it was a Swiss man, is that correct, Hoffman, who was discovered LSD. Now, way back in 1,000,000 years ago, my first training was actually as a pharmacy technician. One of the things we learned about was a drug that was actually just coming off market at that time, which was called ergotamine, which was used for migraines and often would be prescribed with caffeine tablets. It used to have dreadful side effects for its patients. We would sometimes get young women who'd had very bad migraines. They'd take too much of it, and then they'd have sort of really crazy, trippy dreams and all of those sorts of things. And then that's when I discovered that the basis of ergotamine was also the same basis for LSD and the work the Swiss did on that. So sort of talk us about how you went from blitzed to tripped. So what was the mechanism between point A and point B between those two books?
When I researched blitz, I basically tried to examine everything that the Nazis did with drugs. And the two main stories are the army on methamphetamine and Hitler abusing opioids, cocaine, and other drugs. So these are the two kind of pillars of Blitz. But I also came across psychedelic research that the SS did in the concentration camp of Dachau. And being interested in psychedelics myself personally for many years, I thought that was quite unusual because the Nazis were not really psychedelic people. I mean, they were the opposite. They were about meth, you know, following orders, doing stuff, you know, not thinking, just doing. And psychedelics are like the opposite. So psychedelics and Nazis don't really go together at all. But why they were interested in it in the concentration camp of Dachau, they did tests on inmates because they were fascinated with the idea of developing what they called a truth drug. Nazis were all paranoid all the time. They always thought, you know, that within their own ranks, their enemies, and Hitler was, you know, there were many assassination attempts on Hitler. So he was also behind this like hunt for the truth drug. You just give suspicious people a substance and then those people will, you know, reveal all their secrets. That was basically the simplistic idea of the German intelligence at the time, which was the Gestapo and the SS, basically, police force and intelligence. I thought I also have to research what was going on, really. But at the time, the archive is from the memorial of the concentration camp of Dachau. They have an own archive in that place. He said that the Americans took all the most of the SS reports on psychedelic research. I only found like one page where they hinted at the research. One page, the Americans left one page basically, but they took, you know, all the other pages. So I really wanted to find them to figure out what actually happened with that topic. And that basically took another book. I couldn't fit that into Blitz because it turned out to be quite a huge story, and that's the story of Tripped, and I can tell you that story, but I don't want to.
You can go on as much as you like, because it does sound like a fascinating story. So what happened?
Many things happened. Basically what happened, in because you asked about how LSD actually originated, and that was in 1938 for the first time, the company Sandoz in Switzerland, and Switzerland was a neutral country, didn't side with the Nazis or with the Western allies. Basically, they sided with both sides. You know, that's a typical Swiss way of getting through the day. That's their neutrality. They basically work with everyone. So what they were trying to do in 38 was develop more medicines out of ergot, because as you mentioned, ergotamine, that was their key to develop medicines. That was basically the only natural resource they used for many years, and that actually created the wealth of the company, because ergot, a fungus that grows on rye, is very poisonous, but very poisonous means it's very potent. So if you just extract the alkaloid, which is one of them is ergotamine, you can make, you know, potent medicines out of it. For example, migraine medicines. And one of the medicines they made out of it was LSD, and it's just one other, you know, thing you can make out of ergot. But they had no idea, obviously, what it was. They just created, they isolated the acid within the ergot, which is lysergic acid, and the chemist turned it into diethylamide, which is a chemical, you know, process. So he had lysergic acid, diethylamide, and he wasn't sure what it was good for. He gave it to the mice, like it was usually done, animal experiment, and the animals didn't show any effects. So in 1938, LSD was basically shelved. It didn't show any potential. But then in 1943, the chemist, his name was Albert Hofmann, he looked at LSD again, which was kind of unusual because when stuff was shelved, it was not looked at again. But he had kind of a notion that maybe this LSD is good, and maybe the mice, you know, react, you know, maybe they had an experience which men and women didn't see. So he tried it on himself And he had a very strong experience. And then he communicated this to his boss, the CEO of Sandoz. He said, I took like a very, very small amount of this odorless and tasteless substance called LSD-25. It was the name that they gave it at the time. And I had for 10 hours the most incredible experience in my mind. You know, his body was just normal. Like, he called his doctor and the doctor like checked his heart rate and said, I cannot detect anything. But he was like tripping on 250 micrograms of pure LSD. The walls were moving and the colors were different. And it was a full blown LSD trip, but he had no idea what it was, you know, because it was the first one in the world. So they discussed it in the company and they thought, maybe this is a different type of medicine, a medicine that doesn't work on the body, but the medicine that works on the mind. And now the interesting thing is that the CEO communicated this finding of LSD with his best friend. And his best friend was Richard Kuhn. He was a German biochemist, and the Swiss CEO and the German biochemist had been friends since the 20s. Like, they had had the same teacher, which was a Jewish-German biochemist called Wildstätter. So these were his two master students, Kuhn the German and Stoll the Swiss. And they had always exchanged their findings from early on, and they were still exchanging the findings in the 40s, even though Richard Kuhn was by now Hitler's leading biochemist, had actually received the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, so he was quite a good chemist. And when he heard that in Switzerland, which was just like 150 kilometers away, this odorless and tasteless, extremely potent substance that changes the mind had been developed or found, he became very interested in it because he was working on the truth drug at the time. So he actually asked the Swiss company to get his hands on ergotamine. And he received it. I found a letter that where he thanks the Swiss CEO. I found this in the archives of Sandoz in Basel. It's actually quite hard to find, but at one point I had this letter in my hand where the Nazi thanks the neutral Swiss guy for receiving all this ergotamine, which he then could easily turn into LSD in one simple step in his lab in Heidelberg. So that is interesting because that is kind of the smoking gun or the paper trail showing that the Nazis had knowledge of LSD and were not only using mescaline in the concentration camp of Dachau, but you know, also another odorless and tasteless substance, which is much more potent and which is much better to give unwittingly to people, because mescaline has a bitter taste. So the Nazis became quite interested in LSD. They thought, maybe this is it. This is the truth drug. With LSD, we can detect any, you know, traitors or enemies. So they started. They started and continued their research in Dachau. And then the Americans came only like about 1.5 years later. They liberated Dachau, found the SS reports on the psychedelic research, and then in their turn became very interested in LSD. First the American military, which immediately had was confronted with a new war, the Cold War, with the Soviet Union, where also a truth drug might be quite helpful. And that's how basically the LSD came into the focus of the American military and then the American intelligence service, CIA. And that was first the Nazis, then the American intelligence service became interested in CIA, in LSD. That was really bad start for LSD as a potential medicine, because these organs were interested in LSD not as a medicine, but as a potential weapon.
Did I read that Hoffman, right at the beginning, once he experimented on himself and he had that insane trip, but then realized that it was such a strong psychotropic drug that there could have been medical applications at the time that they wanted to develop, but he never had the ability to be able to do that. So it just got sort of siphoned off into military history, as it were.
LSD became like a project for Sandoz, which was very they were very optimistic with LSD in the beginning. Also, they didn't know. I mean, the Swiss CEO sends samples to the Nazi biochemist, but still, you know, the company doesn't officially, you know that or is not reacting to that. They were trying to develop it as a medicine. The first thing they did was they created what they called an intoxication room within the company. I think it was very funny in the mid 40s in this, you know, very normal Swiss pharmaceutical company, that they had this room where employees from the company could go, you know, bookkeepers or chemists or, you know, anyone who worked there could go and taste LSD and then kind of report to a secretary. She was sitting there typing what people were saying, and everyone was raving about LSD. They all loved it. It was an unusual thing, you know, to take this and suddenly you see the sky. They looked out the window and they saw how beautiful the clouds were, and they looked around the room and they looked at a flower and they were like just totally amazed by what happened with them. And I quote a lot of these reports in Tripped, and they're quite funny to read. So these normal Swiss people suddenly had a revelation that life is, you know, amazing, and that they're part of the universe and all that stuff that we still have when we take LSD today. So Sandoz thought that maybe this is great. This is like a mood enhancer. This like maybe could cure people's traumas and depression, because this was a very traumatic and depressive time. You know, it was World War II. Towards the end, many people were injured and had trauma and were depressed and had no, you know, didn't know how to continue living in this totally destroyed Europe. And then the company tested it also on mentally challenged people, like people with depression or mostly people with depression, actually, in a Zurich hospital. And also these people reacted very positively, like they were cured from their depression through LSD. So Sandoz thought they have like a big hit on their hands, because it was a very successful company to begin with. And they thought if they now expand into the psychedelic sphere, which was totally unknown at the time, they could like become, you know, the global leaders of psychedelic medicines. And they tried to do that. But then at the time, like in the early 50s, when they were really trying to develop LSD as a medicine, that's when the interest of the CIA in LSD peaked. And there was a meeting with the CEO of Sandoz in Basel and the head of the MK Ultra program, which was the program within the CIA to develop LSD as a mind control drug. And basically, the Americans put pressure on the Swiss. They said, we're not going to allow LSD to be developed without our notice. Like, we must be in the loop of everything, because they were afraid, the Americans, that, for example, Sandoz would sell LSD also to the Soviet Union, and maybe the Soviet Union would develop a truth drug out of LSD before the Americans did. So Sandoz was not free anymore with its LSD development. Basically, the CIA said, if you don't listen to us now, we and our friends from the FDA will, you know, make it very hard for you in general to put any medicines on the market. So the Swiss CEO basically gave in to this pressure. From that moment on, the CIA was in the driving seat of what would happen with LSD, and they had very different ideas, obviously, than the pharmaceutical company.
One of the things I found really interesting was that patents and the whole drug development is huge, because that is the period of time that you have to cash in on whatever development that you made. And with LSD, it was patented in 1948 and the patent expired in 1965. Now, it's only a very short hop, skip and a jump to 1968, which is when LSD burst into the cultural scene in the United States. So what did you find out about that period of time? You know, the CIA would have been busy working away on their truth serum. So what sort of happened in that period of time that saw LSD slip out from the secret truth serum drug into this burgeoning psychedelic youth culture?
While the CIA was happily working along with their LSD research, which was actually unethical criminal research, because they did a lot of human experiments in the United States on American citizens without telling them. They also did experiments with their own colleagues, like in the morning in the CIA office, you would get like a drop of LSD in your coffee without anyone telling you, and then they would see how colleagues reacted. So that whole CIA mind control, MKUltra, LSD research is very problematic. And basically, it didn't lead anywhere. I mean, they found out that you could severely distract someone with LSD. You could, you know, crush someone's ego. You could basically hurt someone with LSD because it is such a powerful mind drug. And if you don't know that you've just taken it and suddenly you have totally different thoughts and perceptions, you might think you go crazy. And then, you know, that in that respect, LSD might work, but they were never able to really turn it into this magic key with which you can unlock, you know, the secrets of someone else, or you could program someone. Like the Manchurian Candidate they were never able to do that. And while they were doing their unsuccessful, unethical research, there was also still the normal research going on by brain scientists and neuroscientists and people that were interested in human consciousness, trying to use LSD as a tool to understand more about our mind. So that was actually quite... There was a lot of research on LSD. Like there were thousands of research papers, but it takes, you know, it does take years and years to develop an actual medicine out of it. So before the normal, the ethical, the scientific research was able to, you know, make a medicine, a product out of LSD, it became illegal. And why did it become illegal? I mean, it's kind of a... funny is the wrong word, but it's kind of ironic that the CIA did also tests with individuals that then kind of turned the experience around. One of the guinea pigs that they used, for example, and they used many, many, many guinea pigs, but one of them was Ken Kesey, who had been a writer, an aspiring writer, and he took he received $75 from the CIA to take LSD. He took part in a experiment in Menlo Park in California, and he had the idea that LSD, you know, he had a great trip. He had the idea for his novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he realized a lot of things on LSD, and he then became one of the LSD prophets. Basically, he just, after his big success with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he decided not to write anymore, but just to buy a bus and paint it and drive around the bus with his friends through the United States and just distribute as much LSD as he could. And he's just one example of how the LSD kind of spilled from the CIA into the counterculture. That's why John Lennon at one point said, we have to thank the CIA for giving us LSD. I mean, it could have also spilled from the regular research into the counterculture, but the regular research was at universities, like in labs. Like it wasn't out there like the CIA research. Like the CIA, they really opened Pandora's box, and LSD, which was this obscure, you know, chemical, you know, no one thought that it would become the most popular drug in the world. But because it's such a great drug, it's such a great substance, or at least many people in the 60s perceived it as such a fun and insightful and spiritual experience. It became, you know, word of mouth was spreading, and it became, you know, very popular. And at one point it was so popular that within the growing peace movement against the Vietnam War, LSD was like the drug of choice. People were really using, a lot of people were using it, and the first, you know, illegal LSD chemists popped up and mass produced LSD. It's also something that you can, it's not easy to make it, but you can make it if you're a good chemist. And one chemist can make like millions of dosages, basically, because you only need like small amounts. So LSD really went out of control, you could say, because of the strange handling it had received in the United States. The American government, in order to have something in their hands against the peace movement, then decided to schedule LSD and put LSD into Schedule 1. Schedule 1 is that category in the U.S. where dangerous drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine, then Schedule 1 or fentanyl, or then Schedule 1 because they have no medicinal value. They're just dangerous and make you addicted. So LSD really landed in the wrong category because it's, you know, it has a lot of medicinal potential, but the American government is the American government.
The CIA then seeded, so they then seeded LSD out into the wider culture, into
right.
Yeah. So what to what end do you think? Did your research unearth that? Why were they wanting to get this out so it could be distributed amongst this youth culture? Was this part of a grand experiment?
No, they didn't want
that. They didn't want that. So how did it get out?
Well, they gave people LSD that was part of MK Ultra, that people were given LSD. And then they were, you know, observed how they would react. And, you know, that was part of the mind control research. And then some people, you know, basically took it like Ken Kesey, just, you know, they just took it.
Because there had to have been a chemist somewhere that was able to replicate it, to distribute it outside of governmental control.
I mean, the first one that did it was Owsley III, is his name. He was the son of a Kentucky governor, and he was, or the grandson, I'm not sure, but he was like a Southern American guy, and he was interested in chemistry, and his girlfriend was a chemist. So he was able to make LSD. Basically, he said, I just borrowed books from a public library, and together with my girlfriend, we were able to make LSD. And then he started distributing it illegally, and people loved it. That's basically how it started. And then one of the early LSD chemists, Owsley was the first, and then there was another kind of generation, which was like, I think, three or four guys. And one of them, his nickname was the Bear. And the Bear was also the sound engineer for the Grateful Dead. And his idea was to use the concerts of the Grateful Dead as marketplaces, you know, distribute and sell LSD there. And so that's how it spread. So the CIA made it kind of public unwillingly, and people really expanded on it.
So then it gets landed into Schedule 1 and
right.
becomes illegal. So, and that is in an effort to shut down this burgeoning beatnik peace movement. So the unaffected consequence of that, as you said, so does all the research then shut down on this drug? As you said, there were benefits, there were research projects going, and I guess the stigmatization then started.
Yeah, I mean, the main problem really is that by making LSD illegal, also the research became illegal, and scientists had to suddenly stop, you know, and they couldn't get their hands on LSD anymore, because in a university you can't just buy LSD from the black market and continue your research. I mean, you could, but it would be a criminal activity. And scientists usually don't engage in criminal activities, so they had to stop.
And with the patent dropping in 1965, there was no financial incentive for anybody to lobby to have further research done, because there would be no money to be made.
I mean, Sandoz, I think they could have behaved maybe differently, because they immediately also stopped distributing LSD in other countries, even though it was still legal in other countries. So Sandoz was really on the side of the American government in a way. Maybe they received pressure again in 65 when it was made illegal to not even distribute it into other countries. But this, I mean, they certainly didn't. So that was a really heavy blow to LSD. And then came the media campaign against LSD, which was also fueled by the Americans, by the CIA. I mean, the CIA had a specific program to influence mainstream media. And they influenced mainstream media by, you know, telling them, and they told the world how dangerous LSD is, which is, you know, completely unfounded. Like, scientifically, it's not true that you could, you know, have, you know, whatever, you know, all kinds of diseases if you take LSD. Your brain, you know, it wouldn't be healthy for your brain. The opposite is actually true, we find out now. So really, research into very, very promising medicines was stopped then, and only picked up again basically in 2015, when a professor at Johns Hopkins University, Professor Griffith, could show that psilocybin, which is like a cousin of LSD, can cure very severe depression, treatment-resistant depression, I think it's called. That's when slowly the doors opened again for psychedelic research. And some other researchers, I met one researcher in Switzerland who was able in the early 90s already to do some LSD research, because Switzerland actually being the home of LSD and not having signed all the treaties within the United Nations, which outlaw, you know, the substances. In Switzerland, there was a little bit and is a little bit more freedom. So he already started in the mid-90s, but basically we lost half a century of research into things that could cure us from dementia, for example.
Yeah, my husband's a retired doctor, and I said to him, I was talking to you, and this was the topic. And he said, you know, there's been a lot of work with psilocybin, also too with post-traumatic stress disorder for people that are suffering with that. They've started studies there. And he said also with LSD, they did start around with addictions. He said there was something in the dopamine receptors in the brain to help people who were suffering from chronic addiction. So there is work that can be done, but it's that whole stigmatization of the drug still being illegal in most places that make it very, very difficult for any further work to conclude.
And it's totally absurd, because LSD does help with addiction from like opioids and alcohol. So like to have these drugs legal and to make LSD illegal is like, it just doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make sense at all.
When you were doing your research, both for Blitzed and now for Tripped, and you saw how governments and movements reacted in that time for the programs that they were rolling out, did you have that moment of that clarity where history can actually teach you for things that are going on today? Did you see things and you thought, wow, they did that then and we're now seeing that rolled out now with other things? Or did you ever have that kind of moment?
You mean with psychedelic research?
Well, not necessarily psychedelic, but in terms of how attitudes towards either other drugs or even things like current pharmaceuticals with the pandemic, you know, all of those sorts of things, the use of media and propaganda and whether something is marketed as a hero or a demon, those sorts of things. Did you see any parallels from what happened in the 40s, 50s and 60s, what has been currently happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the same thing. I mean, we still have the war on drugs. I just think, I mean, even then, you know, it doesn't make sense in a democratic society that the government tells you, now we're going to put up a chemical wall in your brain and you cannot, you know, go to the other side. It just doesn't make sense in democratic societies. And that tendency has only, you know, gotten worse. I mean, slowly now it's opening, which does make me a little bit optimistic that we're changing our mind in that. So there's a little bit of progress now. And if you look at, I think Australia now allowed psilocybin in treatments, and Switzerland also allows more and more. And an American company realized through clinical studies that LSD in microdosages might help against Alzheimer. And that is actually what I want to talk about to you now. That was for me personally very interesting, because my mother suffers from Alzheimer. And when I read the scientific paper, I discussed this with my father, who takes care of my mother, and he said he has no medicines available to give to her. And he's a former judge in Germany, so he's not a drug person really. And he said, so why, if this is helpful, why can't I get it in the pharmacy? That's basically the research that I did for Tripped. That's why Tripped in the beginning was called LSD for Mom, because that was my incentive to research LSD, to figure out, can it really help against dementia? Can it really help my own mother? That same publisher that once told me to make a nonfiction book out of Blitz then told me LSD for Mom is not a good title and should be called Tripped, which I think is a big mistake. I think LSD for Mom is a much better title, because it really expresses the emotional urgency that I had writing this book. And after I presented my father all my research on LSD, We discussed it. He said, "Yeah, let's talk with your mom. Let's talk with my wife." And she consented. She said, "Yeah, let's try it." And then, you know, he gave her and still gives her small dosages of LSD once in a while. Not every day, because you shouldn't give a drug every day, basically. Any drug you shouldn't give chronically, or it could be a problem because, you know, tolerance builds. But once in a while, she receives a drop in her coffee. Her cognitive abilities are improved for that day. Her mood is improved. She can talk much better with us than if she's not on LSD. So it seems like that white paper of that company claiming that the very same receptors that Alzheimer kills are being revived or stimulated through LSD. It seems that this is actually working in our family. That's why this book Tripped, aka LSD for Mom, is kind of an optimistic book too, and has become a very personal project for me, actually.
How is she doing?
I mean, you cannot say that LSD cures Alzheimer, because the disease continues to spread in her brain, I would guess, would be the right description. But my father's convinced that it slows it down. He was actually on German TV telling you know, about his experiences. It's good. I totally believe that LSD is good against dementia, because what is scientifically also proven is that LSD and psilocybin and other psychedelic compounds reduce what is called neuroinflammation of the brain. So our brain, you know, is in a certain, you know, state, and it can be inflamed. I don't know if that's the right word in English.
Inflamed.
And that is the key, huh? Inflamed.
Inflamed.
It can be inflamed. And, you know, you wouldn't notice if your brain is inflamed. It has to do with your nutrition and all kinds of things. And an inflamed brain is more likely to develop dementia. That's one of the chief causes for dementia, is inflammation of the brain. And psychedelic compounds work against inflammation. So I think that it's really healthy, actually, to take psychedelic compounds if you know what you're doing. And if you get, you know, if you have the right material, I think it's really healthy. I think LSD is actually a brain food in low dosages, especially. So my perception on the psychedelic compounds really changed during the research of Tripped.
And it will be interesting to see how these things progress, because I know that people have moved on in terms of medical marijuana. There was a time that, you know, you would have to source those things, cannabis oils and the like, illegally in order to help particularly cancer patients. And now the research has been done, the work has been done, and you're able to get that prescribed for people who have a variety of conditions. So fingers crossed the same may happen for LSD for those that need it. In terms of the next steps, now that you've got the taste for nonfiction books, what's next in the pipeline, Norman?
I have become very interested in how drugs shape our history or shape kind of who we are. So I want to engage in a broader overview of this topic for my next book. Look at different periods of history and kind of look at the question of, are we only humans because we consume psychoactive compounds? Like, how old is this, and what cultural developments can we link to psychoactive compounds? Because I do think that we need a completely different understanding of psychoactive compounds. They're not our enemies. Some of them are so potent, so they might be, you know, they're dangerous that come with them. But basically, if we have a different approach to them, if we understand that they're basically our friends if we use them correctly, and our long-term companions, I think that would be an important step to go forward. I think we need a complete change in our attitude and viewpoint, and a complete legal change, obviously, also. So I'm kind of working on that. And after that, I'll write a new novel. But first, I'm going to write one more nonfiction book on this topic, because I think it's highly interesting.
Well, I know Graham Hancock, he wrote Ancient Apocalypse. That was something that he came across when he was looking for this advanced civilization. He hypothesized that there was a civilization that existed in culture around about 13,000 years BC, sort of somewhere in there, about 12,000-ish years. And there's a lot of evidence across multiple continents of a society that is quite advanced, had technology beyond its time. It seems to have disappeared. And it also, he's researched and he believes that there may have been some form of celestial type event that created a mass extinction for this group of, well, this society, the civilization. And one of the areas that he's researched is the use, particularly in South America and other places, where they wonder the use of things like ayahuasca and the like for these naturally occurring psychotropic compounds helped these civilizations to obtain greater levels of knowledge that was available from a technological point at that time.
Yeah, I mean, these topics are highly interesting. So
Yeah, well, it sounds
after Blip and Tripped, I'll go for a third one. That will be then the trilogy.
Then you're done.
Yeah, then I'm done. Yeah.
Oh, then you're done.
And I just write novels and invent stuff, which is also great.
Oh, no, that sounds fantastic. One last question that I've got, and it comes out of your bio, and it's a completely different pivot, but I have to ask. You were a resident writer in residence in Ramallah back in the day, and the last person to interview Yasser Arafat. What was that like? What was he like?
That was actually a very funny meeting because I was quite stoned because I didn't know that meeting would take place, and I was bored in my apartment in Ramallah, and I ate a hash cookie that I had with me. Basically out of boredom, I wanted to get inspired, so I ate this hash cookie, and suddenly I get a call that I would meet Arafat in like 30 minutes, and I was really high, actually, and a car pulled up outside my apartment. I mean, I was like poet laureate of Ramallah for a time through the German Cultural Institute, so my job was to write about the daily life of the Palestinians. And I really wanted to meet Arafat, but it was very difficult, obviously, but suddenly someone made it possible, and I got this call, and I got into this car, and the car drove to the Mukata, which was his half-destroyed compound in Ramallah, where he was residing would be the wrong word, basically living in his uniform, and I was led through like a maze of hallways, and suddenly I was in a room, and he was actually sitting there, and he looked like a space alien, basically, which he looked like a completely different entity. He was quite very, very small, and he approached me in his uniform with this thing on his head. Like, he really looked iconic. And then we had a very lovely lunch together, just him and me, for like 2 hours, and it was quite a memorable experience, the talks we had. And and 3 weeks later, he was dead, which completely surprised me, because when I met him, he didn't seem ill. I mean, he was shaking, so I guess he had maybe Parkinson's, or he was old also. So he was not completely healthy, but his mind was, he was good, basically. So that was it. And now I guess we all need Arafat, but he's not there anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's also, we've just lost our Māori king here, which is quite a big figure very suddenly. And yeah, you don't always know when that last conversation will be. So I guess that's certainly something to address. Yeah.
I think I was the last European to speak to him, because after that he was, he died. So yeah. It was interesting.
Well, there you go. Well, look, it's been absolutely fascinating this morning, Norman. I really do appreciate your time. Where can people find the books if they're wanting to purchase them? I know Blitzed, I've definitely seen Blitzed, the local bookstore at the end of my street, so that's definitely widely available. Is Tripped now available and out for people to purchase?
Yeah, absolutely. I received a link recently that it's in the independent bookshop's best-selling list in your country.
Excellent.
So I would imagine that bookshops would have it, and of course I would encourage you to go to your local bookshop, and if they don't have it, I guess they could order it for you, so you would have it the next day. And if that doesn't work out, just go to any big online shop, but you can get it. You can get it.
Yeah. Oh no. That's wonderful. This has been Norman Ohler. He is the New York best-selling author of, as we said, Blitz, Drugs in Nazi Germany, and then Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. So make sure you check those out. And what have we got a working title for the third one?
Yeah, but I can't reveal it yet.
Oh, okay. There you go. Too good.
Okay. We talk about it next time.
Okay. There we go.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.